This is the No Dava Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Bob Crowley, a .NET developer and speaker living in Maine. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Bob.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Brian.
So to start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. I'm a .NET developer in Portland, Maine. I've been doing it for probably at least 15 or 16 years now. Was doing a little bit of systems admin before that, but really loving the .NET stack and line of business apps. Doing a little bit of speaking, talking at code camps. Just got my first conference under my belt this past winter at CodeMash, so really enjoying that. Looking forward to more.
CodeMash, that's out in Minnesota, isn't it?
The CodeMash is in Ohio.
I'm sorry, I got mixed up with it. Another cold place in January. Were you presenting on debugging out there?
I certainly did, yes.
How did it go?
It went pretty well. Yeah, I had approximately 100 people, and I got good feedback, so that's always a plus.
Nice. And then for anyone listening in the Boston area, you're going to be at Boston Code Camp 6th of April, is that right?
6th of April, that's right. I'm going to be there whether I'm speaking or not, so hopefully we'll see you there.
And that's in Burlington, the Microsoft campus, Microsoft office north, about 10 miles north of Boston.
That's right. Yeah.
So to get back to a little bit about yourself, so what kind of .NET do you do typically?
So I do a lot of back-end stuff. I write APIs a lot. Also do a lot of maintenance on existing applications, which go all the way back to, you know, Windows Communication Foundation, even some VBA. Not that I like to admit that, but, you know, we have to keep the lights on. So everything from .NET Core APIs all the way down to web forms and WCF.
Tonight, we're going to talk mainly about debugging, because that's what you've been giving talks on in the last year or so. And I came across a quote some time back when I was using a tool called Glimpse. Anthony van der Horn and Nick Molnar, they used to have a quote up on their page from Brian Kernighan, which said, "Everyone knows that debugging is twice as hard as writing a program in the first place. So if you're as clever as you can be when you write it, how will you ever debug it?" What do you think of that?
I couldn't agree more. Debugging is very important. Writing clear, concise code makes debugging that much easier. And one of the reasons for me talking about this is to make people better at debugging. And so you'll be better at debugging your terribly complicated code.
But have you had times when you've written something extremely complicated and then had to debug it and found that it was, you know, a significantly more difficult task than you expected?
Absolutely, yes. It's very difficult to go back to your code, even just maybe a few weeks ago, you know. But seeing stuff you've written before and trying to be clever and maybe writing a bunch of expressions on a single line and being elegant is just not the way to go. You really want to break it up. It really helps with readability, and readability helps with debuggability.
Yeah, speaking of expressions on a single line, I remember I worked in a company once and someone had written a query to the database using link, and I think it was about 8 lines long, and I couldn't understand it. He couldn't understand it anymore. And then we needed a query that was like it, so we copy-pasted it and changed the things we knew we needed to change. It was impossible.
Yeah, those link queries can get pretty ugly pretty fast, especially if you're doing a bunch of left joins. There's no way to understand what it's doing.
So when you present, you obviously are presenting on debugging, so you must explain why you think debugging is so important. So can you tell me why?
Sure. It's important because, first of all, for software quality. But learning debugging is important because it's not really taught in the universities. You know, it's pretty much console.WriteLine is what you get by with. I actually had a coworker of mine say that when he was in college and he heard about breakpoints for the first time, he was like, I'm not ever going to need breakpoints. And it was interesting because I had the exact same experience. So to hear him say that made me think, you know what, this really is valid. Plus, I spend a fair amount of time on Stack Overflow. I actually learn a lot by trying to answer questions, but I also see a lot of questions where it's very obvious that the person doesn't know how to debug at all. They just don't even know how to step through code. And so I know there's an audience out there for this topic, and so I'm just trying to get it out.
Do you think debugging should be taught in university, Bob?
I do think it should be taught in the universities. They don't teach it. It makes it much harder to program. You know, you're already kind of overwhelmed with learning programming if you're not used to it. And just some very basic techniques would be a really huge help. Because basically, you know, debugging at that level is nothing but, you know, writing messages to the console. And that's very inefficient and just makes your task of finishing your assignments much harder.
But in university, when I was in university, I had to figure out how to use, I think it was DDD and GDB myself. But, you know, I was using some IDE. This is back, going back 17, 18 years. I think I was using Borland C, and then I was using something else in Linux. I was using whatever it was that you'd program C++ in Linux back then. But at universities now, do they have the big IDEs? Do they have the Visual Studios, the Visual Studio codes, and so on?
They do have more modern IDEs now, as far as I know. When I was in school, we used Visual Studio. It was before .NET. I can't remember what it was called. But, you know, they're using maybe Eclipse. They're using Visual Studio. So, you know, not everyone, but they are using more modern IDEs, and they certainly have, you know, the debugging capabilities accessible.
When you're talking about debugging, or maybe, you know, explaining to people, what are the things that you think people should know how to debug?
So I think it's important to, and I like to call this knowing your tech stack. So if you're doing web development, you know, you're probably writing code in a kind of a higher level abstraction. You know, you've got the ASP.NET MVCs, you've got the different CRM frameworks. It really shields you a lot from what's going on under the hood. But when you're having trouble, it's really going to help you a lot if you know HTTP, if you know what the verbs mean, the get, the post, the put. It's going to really help if you know what a header is and what they mean and what's the difference between a query string and the request body and understanding the response. So you can get a long way using these higher level frameworks. But when you run into trouble, you know, that's something you need to know. You need to know your HTTP. And likewise, line of business apps, you're hitting databases. So SQL is very important to know. You know, even if you're using an ORM like Entity Framework, you know, knowing SQL is going to help you a lot when you're trying to diagnose some kind of problem with getting data.
But for either of these things, or particularly with SQL, diagnosing what's happening with a request isn't necessarily trivial. So like, if you're generating something like a HTTP request, to know what's actually being sent out, you're probably going to have to intercept that request along its way. Or is there a different methodology you'd advocate for?
No, that's right. You know, intercepting the requests along the way, you can use profilers or traces for that. But also you can look in, for instance, with the .NET framework, you have things like HTTP client, the system.net.http client. You know, you can get to the request details and the response details. So you can see all that stuff. But if you don't know what it is, you don't know what you're looking at. So I find it helps to use a tool like Postman or a tool like Fiddler that really gives you the raw guts of what's going over the wire. You know, just looking at that, looking at your code, looking at what it sends out, what it receives, and then looking at the trace, you know, you can correlate these things together and really get a good picture of what's going on and really help you with being a better web developer.
So I've tended to use Fiddler. I know Postman is very, very popular. What would you say are the kind of the competing features of the two?
So I see Fiddler much more as a tracing tool and a request tool. You can basically capture web requests that you're sending out from different applications. You know, it acts as a proxy. So if you're using a browser or if you're sending stuff in code, you know, Fiddler can intercept those and you can see the HTTP traffic and you can inspect it. You can resend, you can replay, you can modify those requests and send it. A lot of that stuff you can do in Postman, but where Postman really shines is it's more of a testing tool. So you can write pre-request scripts and you can write post-request scripts, although they call them tests. So they have pre-request and then they have tests. And you can manipulate what you're sending in the pre-request. And then in the test script, you can actually assert what you've gotten back. So let's say you're expecting that the body of a request is expected to contain the word foo. You can write a test in the Chai script language and assert that. If you're expecting a certain header value, basically anything. You're writing Chai test script in JavaScript and Postman will run those tests. It'll give you a report of how many passed, how many failed. It'll give you the messages. So really Postman is more for testing and Fiddler is more for, I suppose, fiddling.
But can you make Postman part of your CI/CD? Are you advocating for it to be that kind of testing or is it more for sort of I'm learning stuff and I'm going to test this out before I formalize my tests in coded C# unit tests, for example?
You can absolutely integrate that into CI/CD. I think it's a great tool just for getting your feet wet, you know, learning how this works. But as you advance and you want to use this for running integration tests, it actually has a companion command line tool called Newman. And what you can do is you can set up all of your tests in Postman and export them as a JSON. And then you can pass those files to the command line tool Newman in your build pipeline. And it will give you a standard exit code of 0 or 1. And that's how your test will know if it passed or failed. So absolutely, it can help you in that regard.
And then do you use Postman as well for inspecting responses when you're, you know, constructing your requests? It's not fire and forget effectively.
That's correct. Yep. It also has a console, much like your browsers, which will trace everything where you can see absolutely everything that went in the request and the response. It also has features where you can line up a whole bunch of tests at once and just click one button and it will run them all and give you a report.
Where do you see packet sniffers fitting in, though? Things like TCP dump or Wireshark in relation to HTTP.
So that's where you really get into the nitty-gritty. Hopefully, you don't ever have to go that deep. If you have to go that deep, hopefully you're either really good at knowing what a TCP packet looks like. I will be honest, I do not. But hopefully that's where, if you really just can't figure it out, you have your infrastructure team do some kind of packet sniffing and hopefully they can, you know, diagnose a problem. Because at that level, it's probably not your code. It's probably some kind of environmental issue.
And one thing to be aware of with packet sniffing is your security team may well be watching for packet sniffers. So don't be surprised if you get tapped on the shoulder, or maybe go and let them know ahead of time that you're going to be doing it.
Well, that's the truth. Yeah, I would not be able to install one on my machine at work. As a matter of fact, I installed a decompiler on my machine, and the next morning I logged in and it had been uninstalled. So yeah, they're definitely overlooking everything.
And then for SQL, so like, again, we said, you know, if you took Entity Framework, I program a lot in Entity Framework, it does get translated into SQL somewhere. So how would you look at that if you were debugging? You know, do you debug your Entity Framework, or are you trying to go debug your SQL?
Well, I would debug my SQL. Debugging any framework is difficult. From what I understand, with a tool like OzCode, it's much easier. But if you're running against SQL Server, you can run the SQL Server profiler. And much like Fiddler is capturing HTTP requests, SQL Server profiler is capturing all of your database activity. And so you can run your Entity Framework queries. You can go to your profiler. It'll show you basically all of your statements. It'll show you the values of your parameters to store procedures. It'll show you connections. It'll show you all of that stuff. And a really good tip for this is putting an app name in your connection string. So there are all kinds of attributes you can put in a connection string. If you put an app name, then you can filter your SQL Server profiler to only show you traces from your app name. And that is super helpful when you've got a bunch of developers developing against the same database and it just clutters up the profile. You just want to filter it right down to your stuff. Don't forget about putting app name in the connection string.
Yeah, I was going to say that to you. If you throw the profiler on without a lot of, you know, specified filters, you're going to end up with a huge amount of stuff to look at. And also, you could affect the performance of the database.
That's absolutely true. Luckily, you can do a text search. So if you're looking for a specific store procedure call or certain parameters, you can do a text search to help with that. But the more you can narrow it down, the absolute better it's going to be.
I know with more recent entity frameworks, you can also have the SQL dumped out to the log that's produced. And I think you can do it in two flavors. One where it's the parameters of the command are hidden, but you still get the full select statement or whatever it is. And one where the parameters are included. I can't remember what the switches are, but I think I wrote about it in the blog post, But if you were to use that, let's say for whatever reason you couldn't use a profiler, maybe you're connecting to some type of SQL database that doesn't have it, but you can get at the log of the SQL that's generated. You could then take that, I presume, and throw it into some sort of querying tool that would then hit the database for you.
Absolutely. Yes, SQL Server Management Studio has been pretty much the tool for Microsoft SQL Server developers for years. I understand there's a newer thing that's in preview right now. But sure, if you can get a hold of that SQL, it's really great to just throw it in a tool and run it and see what happens and tweak it a little bit and see what happens then.
All right, so then that's SQL, that's HTTP. What about good old C Sharp? What's your advice there?
So C Sharp, like any language, C Sharp has its own nuances. And the more you know, the better programmer you're going to be, the easier programming is going to be. So, you know, there's always a question, how deep do you go? I personally like to study the language. You know, there are things like I mentioned, that I go on Stack Overflow and I answer questions and I read questions. And I see a lot of misunderstanding and misuse of things. For instance, people are using a data grid and they say, well, I called refresh on the data grid, but it didn't work. But refresh doesn't mean what you think it means. You know, go to the docs, read what it means. Knowing these things, taking what you think it means out of the equation is definitely going to help you be a better programmer.
Within Visual Studio, though, let's take traditional good old Visual Studio. If you're going to start debugging, there's a ton of things that are there that can help you out. If you were going to pick, let's say, a few of those, what would they be?
Okay, first of all, breakpoints. Breakpoints are probably the most basic part of debugging. It just allows you to put a stop on a line, and when you're in debug mode, once your execution point hits that spot, it's going to stop. So breakpoints are critically important, used all the time.
And one thing I didn't learn about breakpoints until a few years into programming was that you can put a conditional on a breakpoint as well, so that if, you know, if it's an if statement, but if you're hitting a statement that's looking at some value, your breakpoint can have a conditional to say if the value is greater than 100, break, and if it's not, then don't break. So maybe you would do it on a loop. You know, you don't want to break until the loop has reached some number of increments.
That's exactly right. It's about turning the knobs and pulling the levers, looking in that breakpoint window. You know, that conditional breakpoint, you can just make an expression. If it evaluates true, it's going to stop. If it does not evaluate true, it's going to keep going. You know, there's even a debug window where you can set a debug breakpoint on a function. So even if you're not looking at the code where a function is, you can go to the menu and set a breakpoint in some function that you know its name. Even the Chrome developer tools now have conditional breakpoints. So it's becoming a common thing, and it's just one of those examples of, you know, just dig a little bit more under the hood and you'll see a lot more goodness.
Then what else would, particularly with Visual Studio, would you recommend using for your debugging?
So bookmarks, I use bookmarks all the time. In Visual Studio, it's a very simple thing to put a bookmark on a line. Very similar to how you'd put a breakpoint, but it doesn't break there. It basically just lets you write a quick little note about what that line is or what it does, some kind of identifier. And that is a lifesaver, especially for large, unfamiliar code bases. So if you're tracking things through all these files and even through projects in a solution, you know, slap a bookmark on, you know, this is where this happens. And then you go on and you trace and you're like, you know what, I need to go look again at that thing. Well, you have a bookmark to it. Otherwise, at least I'm not going to remember where it was. So I use bookmarks constantly. Also, I would talk about the call stack. So every time you stop on a breakpoint, you get a call stack window. So what a call stack is, as you're calling methods and functions, each call gets put on the stack. And when you call another one inside another one, that gets put on the stack, and it just stacks up. And when you're on a breakpoint, you can actually go to that call stack window and kind of travel back in time. You can click on a different frame than the one you're on now, and it will light up all of the parameters and all of the local values in that method, even though it may have been six calls ago. As long as it's still in the stack, you can go and inspect all those variables. And so that's great for seeing what happened, and it's also great for seeing how you got there. So again, with the unfamiliar code bases, you can see if you're in a method or a function, and you know you landed there and you know it's important, but you don't know how you got there. Look at the call stack and you can see all the calls in a line, and you'll know exactly how that flow of execution works.
But to get to that call stack, you'd have had to hit a breakpoint, I think, wouldn't you? The execution needs to be paused.
Yes, you have to be stopped in the debugger. That's right.
Does a call stack apply as equally if you're programming something that's multi-threaded?
It does, yes. Every thread is going to have its own call stack. Visual Studio has tools to make that easier. Historically, debugging threads has been very difficult, you know, because things keep executing as you're trying to debug them. With async and await, if you're familiar with that, it's much easier. It's very much like regular debugging. You almost don't even notice it. But yes, it absolutely applies there.
Then there are a few other things like immediate and watches. What are those?
So the immediate window lets you evaluate expressions in like a terminal window. It has whatever is in scope in the debugger available, so you can write expressions or evaluate values of variables. Locals and watches are where you can see the values of your different objects and variables. Locals are automatically shown to you when you're stopped in a method. Watches are going to stay in that window for your entire session and may go out of scope, and it will tell you if it's out of scope. But anytime that watch is in scope, you're going to get to see the value of it.
Something I occasionally do with the watch and the immediate is I'll change the value of a variable, and then maybe I'll set the cursor to execute at some earlier point so I can run through a piece of code as though it had a different value.
Yes, that's a great way to do things. That's almost like what I call a known good value. It's where you take the result of an API call or a database call or whatever you're doing, and you just comment it out or somehow over hard code a variable to be a known good value. Like, I know that this is what I'm supposed to receive from this service. Now let's continue executing the code and see what happens. So it helps you know what side of the problem you're on. If your code executes fine with that known good value, then maybe there's something wrong with how you're acquiring the data. If it does not execute fine, then it could mean that there's more of a problem with your code downstream.
All of these tools we talked about are in full Visual Studio. Does Visual Studio Code have equivalents for everything?
Visual Studio Code, as far as I know, does not have equivalents for everything, but it is a very rich IDE, and it's getting richer every day. It has a very rich plugin ecosystem. I don't work in code a lot, other than for strictly web applications, you know, front-end web applications. But Visual Studio really has an amazing amount of debugging capabilities.
Yeah, I kind of a side note. At some point, I can't imagine how Microsoft will continue having both Visual Studio and Visual Studio Code. You know, a huge number of developers are moving over to Visual Studio Code, and at conferences, their own internal .NET team and C# team are often presenting on Visual Studio Code.
That's right. I think it's great for web applications. I think it's great for, you know, bring your own language, all these extensions for Python and Node and various things. So it's really becoming a really great tool for especially newer development, like, you know, ASP.NET Core, .NET Core, but not so much if you're going to do WPF.
Yeah, the older stuff.
Universal Windows platform, you know, the more Windows-centric UI stuff, you're not going to go to Visual Studio Code for that.
No, that's true. But I'll bring us back to our topic at hand. Let's say you've been through your various debuggers. You've looked at Fiddler, you've used your database, you've looked at your Visual Studio, but the problem isn't there. If it's something, maybe you've gone through all those and you've determined it's not in them, it's somewhere else. What do you do?
Right. That's the part where you have to become a little bit like Sherlock Holmes. You have to become an investigator. You have to look at the big picture. It really helps if you know a little bit about everything, a little bit about networking, a little bit about servers, a little bit about DNS, because let's face it, our applications don't run in a vacuum. We're operating environments where we rely on all kinds of things. And if your application works great on your machine and it works great in QA, and then you deploy it to production and it doesn't work, well, now what happens? If that's the case, it's, you know, the environment, almost certainly the environment is different. So things that can go wrong are the domain name service, so DNS. You know, maybe you're relying on a certain website in production that you didn't use in QA, and that DNS is not resolving things like service accounts. So when you go to production, you're hitting a different database. The service account to hit that database, maybe it expired. Maybe it doesn't even exist. Dependencies. So in production, you know, you're dependent on maybe a particular version of the .NET framework, you know, particular, maybe a node module if you're not, you know, automatically pulling them from NPM. You know, you have to be aware that these dependencies can be a problem for you. All kinds of environmental factors like this, firewalls. Yeah, you have to basically step through what could happen, observe what's happening, and say, okay, what could possibly make the code do this that isn't the code? And oftentimes you'll come pretty close, and you may need help from infrastructure or whatever, but that's important to put that investigator hat on and just think about what can go wrong.
I've certainly seen those problems in a few companies I've been in, but where I've found that they happen less is when you've got good CI/CD and then good infrastructure as code, whether you're using something like Terraform or something else, so that you can have very similar scripts to build, or maybe identical scripts to build your dev, your QAT, your UA, your dev, your QA, your UAT, and your production.
That's the sweet spot. That's where we all want to get. The reality, at least for me, has been it's just not like that. You know, there's always competing priorities, and there's so many things running on a server. They can't just make it have parity with all the other environments. It's a tough problem, but you know, if you can get there, that's exactly where you want to be. You know, the cloud, Azure, AWS, these are great for getting over those humps. It makes it much easier to have parity in those environments, and it's going to eliminate a lot of debugging if you don't have to be concerned with all those differences.
Yeah, especially containerization is very helpful too, because you know, your container in dev should be identical to your container in production. The difference might be you have 2 or 3 in dev and you might have 100 or 200 in production.
Yeah, I've just started dabbling with containers, trying to lift and shift some old Windows Communication Foundation applications. I got pulled off the project temporarily, but that's kind of our goal, is to take things off of VMs and just throw them up on Azure. So I'm pretty excited about getting back to that.
Yeah, but it complicates debugging beyond, you know, what we're talking about, because now you're so abstracted from your code. excuse me. The challenge is it doesn't look, it's deployed in a different way, it's held in a different way, it's running potentially on a different operating system. You can't necessarily connect a debugger to it. You can't necessarily get at logs so easily. I mean, with CloudWatch, you'll get at the logs, but everything has become harder to look at least until you have a very, very mature CI/CD and infrastructure as code. But until you get to that, it is difficult.
Yeah, I can see that. One of the things about debugging is you need access to the code, and you need to be able to connect to the debugger. So yeah, I can feel that pain.
Yeah, good luck with that with a Linux container for most cases. But another question I wanted to ask you, because again, debugging is one of your things. What do you do when you've been staring at the screen, you've been going through your watches, you've been going through your stack traces, and you cannot see what it is, and you've been at it for a couple of hours?
So the best thing to do when you're spinning your wheels is to stop trying to do it. Just get up, take a walk, whatever you do to clear your head. So if it's lunchtime, go to lunch, take a walk, go talk to somebody, hopefully don't disturb them, but maybe even move to a different project. You know, it's that mind switch. I've been talking about, you know, the take a walk technique for a while, and it wasn't until I went to CodeMash and I did a workshop, but I found out that there's actually a term for that. It's called diffuse thinking. And the presenter was talking about, I believe it was Thomas Edison. He would hold some ball bearings in his hand, and when he started to fall asleep, they would fall out of his hand and wake him up. And that was where he was the most productive as a thinker. So I don't know. I guess it worked for him, but it's, yeah, diffuse thinking. Just stop spinning your wheels. You're really not going to get anywhere. Just have a mind shift, even if it's only a few minutes, and then come back to the problem. Very often, as you're walking away, you're going to think, oh, you know what? I could try, and boom, that's all it takes.
Another thing I came across in one of your slides from a presentation you gave in Boston was a thing called rubber duck debugging. What is rubber duck debugging?
So rubber duck debugging, this is a cute little manifesto on rubberduckdebugging.com. It's basically just running through your code, talking to a rubber duck. So I don't know how many times you have been coding and you have a problem and you call your coworker over and say, look, there's no way this is wrong. Look, see, this line does this, and this line of code does that, and this line, oh, I see what happened. Okay, thanks for coming over. Never mind. You've just taken your coworker away from potentially, you know, he was in the flow or she was in the flow, and now you've just caused them to lose 15 or 20 minutes. Rubber duck debugging is talking to your duck instead of a person, because it accomplishes the same thing. Just step through your code line by line. Almost always, if there's a problem, you're going to see it.
But to be clear, you mentioned rubberduckdebugging.com, but what they advocate is to get a physical rubber duck and put it on your desk and not to talk to the website as such.
No, absolutely. I have one. I actually gave them out at a code camp. Everybody got their own rubber duck. So, yeah, it's very advantageous to have one sitting on your desk the whole time.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening, Bob?
Sure. I'd just like to recap some advice. You know, when you're debugging, know your tech stack. Pull all the knobs and switches. There's so many features in debuggers, even the Chrome dev tools. Don't be afraid to just go poking at everything. You know, they can be overwhelming. There's just so much there that you don't even see it. Just dig in. Another good tip is don't trust code comments. You know, there's a lot of people that say you should never comment your code because it gets stale. You know, people don't update the comments when they update the code. And that's very true. You know, whether or not you are someone who wants comments or not, you can't argue with that fact. So read the comments with a grain of salt and decide for yourself if they're valid or not.
If people want to find you, what's the easiest way?
So my website is contrivedexample.com. It's a blog where I blog once in a while, but you can definitely get in touch with me there.
A Twitter account or anything like that?
Sure. My Twitter account is @contrivedx. Contrived Example is too long, so it's shortened, Contrived X.
I'll include links that you mentioned in the show notes. But other than that, thank you very much for your time, Bob.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
If you like this episode, you might also like episode 86 with Thomas Petrucek on software correctness, or episode 78 with Dustin Campbell on C# 7.1 and beyond, or episode 73 with Bill Wagner on the Microsoft Documentation Service. The opening music was a return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Crisis and Decision by D. Yan Key from the album George Brooker's Leonce and Lena.